listening to Black Hastings Speaks, a production of UC Hastings Law and its Center for Racial and Economic Justice. I'm your host, Arika Smith. This series was created in the aftermath of the killings of Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and George Floyd, and amidst the 2020 uprising sparked by these tragedies. The goals of the project are to foster healing, build connections, encourage systemic change, and deepen empathy on issues of anti-Blackness. In this episode, you'll hear a discussion between Class of 2020 alums Mayel Mergert and Shandon Pierce. Mayel served as president of the Associated Students of UC Hastings. He's headed to work as Associate General Counsel at Liftoff Mobile. Shandon served as president of the Black Law Students Association. He's headed to work as an associate at Mayer's Nave.
I had this memory of sitting in my dad's living room during President Obama's first inauguration. And I remember feeling such hope and surprise, frankly, joy. I remember calling my grandparents and asking them if they ever thought they would see the day. And I remember my dad was really, really quiet. And at first I didn't notice, but then once I did, I kind of asked him, you know, what's up, you know? And he was quiet for a minute. And then he said something along the lines of, this is terrible. And, you know, I was like, what? And he said that white people are going to think that nothing's wrong anymore, that we have no reason to be upset, that the promise is basically fulfilled. And it was such an interesting perspective at the time. It took me a while to digest it. So, and that's something that we discussed when I talked to him recently. So, you know, I guess I think some part of me hoped that he was a bit jaded. But some part of me also knew that he wasn't, living in my own lived-in experience. You know, he was just wiser than I was, which is sad. My partner's been going through an amazing journey. She, you know, she's Afro-Latina, so she comes from two communities of color. And just kind of going through the community of unpacking all the anti-Blackness that takes place in the Latin American community and dealing with that, unpacking what it means to be a beautiful Black woman and to sort of move through spaces and kind of be fetishized and that kind of stuff. And unpacking how we tackle the task of raising a white passing daughter.
Yeah.
You know, that's been a huge, huge topic of conversation. And just the other day, we actually took her to a protest and she marched with us. And it was beautiful and sad. It was beautiful because seeing her out there with that sign, she made my sign. My sign said, am I next? You know, and it was beautiful that here we had my little one making this sign, engaging in like the most fundamental American thing ever, you would think, you know, protesting and freedom of speech and all those wonderful things. But the reason why she was doing it was just incredibly sad.
Yeah.
And seeing her out there marching and looking around, you know, and like, oh, people are yelling and whose name are they yelling? And asking all these questions, it was beautiful to see her come alive in that experience, but just really sad that the reason behind it was just so terrible. So we're just figuring out how to do the initial steps, but it's a journey of years until she fully comes into her own as a young Black woman, I was also a Latina, until she fully has that moment, that full awakening of consciousness, you know?
Mm.
I guess I think our position is really just to be her guides and provide her with the information and the history and the tools to find that information and find that history so that she really has an understanding of what it means to be Black in the United States, and in fact, many places all over the world, and also what it means to be white passing. And I guess, frankly, the responsibility that comes with that, the responsibility to do what you can to use whatever privilege is given to you because you are white passing to ensure that your community is alleviated from suffering and oppression. So that's a work of years. We are not a monolith, and blackness is a vast, beautiful array of things and experiences. But at least in my family, in my experience of what it means to be a black person, my family has always taken great pride in that. And so it was always sort of under everything. And I do remember sort of starting to clue into the fact that being black could be dangerous. And that was a bit different. That was separate from just being black and that being an amazing part of who I was, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that really hit me once I got to, I would say, middle school, because we lived in a town in SoCal that unfortunately has very racist roots.
Mm.
And I was subjected to a lot of racist bullying and all sorts of really terrible things. I mean, one day during a bike ride, my dad and I think I was like 12, my dad and I were riding down the street on our bikes in a van covered in swastikas with a loudspeaker pulled up and said, you know, go home, niggers.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, there were like kind of these points like that where I was like, oh, this could be dangerous. I think it really started to click during middle school when going through those experiences, you know, I was jumped and all sorts of things, all sorts of racial expletives, subject to disciplinary measures by a white administration at the school, who almost always believed that I instigated those instances, all of those things. And it in fact became so bad that I had to change districts in order to protect my peace of mind and myself physically, actually. Mm. So I transferred. So that was probably a big moment of awakening there.
Yeah,
but
that sounds like a lot.
You know, it took years to unpack all of that. But you know, my dad was always really great at just talking about it. You know, he'd say, hey, you know, you're black.
I really do feel like there's like having a cultural understanding. I knew I always was like different, and I feel like I didn't like understand what it meant to be black because we didn't have like that explicit conversation until I think I want to say my dad was changing the alarms in our house, and we lived in a suburb of Seattle, and obviously like my parents own the house and everything, but he's changing the alarm system, and like he like set it off, and just like because it was new, like he couldn't put it back on, and so like the police came and like essentially just like questioned my dad out in the driveway of his own home. And I the entire time was like remember sitting watching Rugrats. I was like maybe like 6 or 5 and like turning around just being like, why are the police here? And like talking to my dad and like him being like very aggressively like, go inside, you know, and just like go inside and like sit there and like don't turn around and like don't look at me, right? And I always like come back to that because like that also is like my first experience with the police, and it was like my dad basically saying go away. And my parents got divorced a few years later, so we never really talked about it when I was an adult, but I only can just like infer so many things. And it's like, you know, why'd he send me away? And did he not want me to get hurt? Did he not want me to see him get arrested? Did he not want all these things? And like, I've always recognized that as like, oh, like I am different. Oh, something's dangerous about this interaction. Oh, I should walk away. And like, as the years went on, like I really like understood more and more and more what that looked like and like why that was, right? And then when my parents were divorced, like that just kind of like went away, and like that ability to be educated about these explicit moments went away, but like the implicit, not implicit, implicit things didn't. So going to Costco and like trying to get a free sample and having like the person always question, where's your parent, right? But my white mom's right behind me, and she had to always say like, no, that's my kid. And just like the looks at like parent-teacher conferences when like your mom walks in, or just that expectation of where's your family, right? And that's like when I noticed, and that's like when I was like, of course, like my mom's great, of course I love her, but like no one else recognizes that she is like connected to me. And seeing like my mom struggle with that and like constantly have to like defend herself made me recognize that as different. And it was just like, I was like, not like a burden, but like it's like there's a burden that comes with being Black. And like for her, it was like raising like a Black kid without like that social signifier that like would be this Black dad with her, or that absence of a parent. And so for me, it just like always made me feel different. Bringing it back to like Hastings, because I probably remember your first day at Hastings, but
yeah,
tell me about it.
I mean, technically my first day at Hastings was moving in prior to the op orientation, but
you can mention
it. Yeah. But anyway, no. Yeah. I mean, that was a whole different experience. So I guess I'll briefly kind of talk about both. Prior to going to layout orientation, I moved into the tower. Mm-hmm. Oh, the tower. So Erika drove me up and she helped me move in, and she drove all of my stuff up in the car and helped me move it in, because she's amazing like that. But I remember her having a conversation with me prior to me coming up here, right before we moved everything. And she was scared. She was scared because at that time, San Francisco and San Francisco PD had sort of just been exploded. There was just so much going on with officers' involvements with prostitutes, as well as excessive force, dealing with the Black population, having that conversation, her being scared for me. Right. And being worried about me moving up here, moving into the city. And so that was sort of my first kind of introduction to Hastings, was having that conversation and moving into the tower and seeing the Tenderloin and be like, okay. So expectation set, only time I'm going to see people who look like me is when I'm walking the streets of the Tenderloin and they're probably not going to the same destination, which would be the law school.
Yep.
Check. Right. And then we have LEOP orientation, which was a fantastic experience. Yeah, first day orientation. We all sat in that big room. Of course, I look around. There's like, again, no Black people. It was a great experience, minus the lack of a central component of diversity, I'll say. Having Black people there and visible isn't the end all of diversity, but I would argue is a central component of diversity.
So when I met you in room B, I was so happy to see like such a diverse room, but you're right. There weren't any Black people. And I think like that to me was, it was just disheartening. That was just so weird. And I was like, oh, for sure. Maybe they just didn't apply to the program. I don't know why you wouldn't, but like, you know what? Like the greater population will be great. And then we went into that, into the rest of the school. I was like, oh, we added Victoria and Greg. And I was like, shit. Like, there's like literally six of us. And I understand, like, I think that was like the first, not like first time I was like, you know, Black people are underrepresented in education, but it was like the first time where I really was like, God damn it. And I was like, I really had to like say like to myself, Nets, it's going to be like a real uphill battle. And I think I just like valued my connection with the five of you more because of that. And it very much is like, you know, we're going to go through this journey together. It will be fine if we all make it. And like, luckily we all did.
And I was about to ask you, what's it like to be Black on campus at Hastings?
I think being Black on campus is pretty isolating in terms of just like pure number, no matter where you go.
Yes, I think unequivocally there is a sort of violence to it and is a type of violence. And I think that my experience of being what I would hope would be classified as sort of a fully realized, reflective and self-aware Black individual in this space for the last 3 years is that it does a sort of spiritual violence to you. There's a sort of spiritual violence that goes on our campus, or at least that's my experience. And I think that really to dig down into the roots of that, I think that I kind of have to talk about the how or the why, I guess. I don't know. I think law school, like, you know, I've only been to one law school, so I can't say law school overall. So I'll say Hastings specifically is decidedly oppressive. I think it's oppressive because I think in my experience has been as a, that fully realized Black person moving through this space is, you know, you kind of made the distinction between there being sort of an explicit expression of oppression. And I get that distinction, but I think if I could put it into a phrase, the silence at Hastings is like deafening. Mm-hmm. It's deafening. That was my experience, right? And in addition to the silence about, you know, sort of just directly engaging with the fact that we have almost no African-American or Black students, and directly engaging with that up front. And then more importantly, that even if we do, as we are now seeing an increase in the numbers of African-American students, right, there's the greater question of whether or not they have the ability to survive versus thrive there, right? And that's a very important difference in how do we ensure that we have a thriving Black community on campus, in addition to thriving other minority communities, or rather communities of color. And I think that my experience has been that the silence on that, answering that question, discussing that question in a very real way was deafening. And that in and of itself was oppressive. And then there's a sort of, I would characterize as gamesmanship or performative aspect that Hastings engages in. Right. I mean, there's always the microaggressions and all those things, but there's also this performative aspect that Hastings engages in that I think for me and for other community members that I've talked to rings really hollow. And that is also a type of violence and a form of oppression. Right. Because it's sort of a very deep denial. Right. I think Hastings suffers from the problem of thinking that being in a liberal city or progressive city and being ostensibly a progressive institution, although I don't think that's true in fact, that somehow it's inoculated from this, right? And I think the lived in experience of many students from communities of color, and I would argue based upon what I've been told and my personal experiences for communities of color, that's just not the case. It's tough. I mean, I think you're constantly swimming through a miasma of just either apathy or performative advocacy. And frankly, very, very large deficit in cultural competency. Buzzwords are everywhere. They're found, they're littered on the ground everywhere. Buzzwords and phrases. But there's a severe lack of cultural competency, like true cultural competency. And that starts at the top, frankly. All of that is very oppressive. It's kind of cloying. And, you know, you kind of talk about your coping mechanism as sort of, you know, if I were to classify it, and it's your experience. So, you know, I hesitate to do that. I think the way that I sort of coped, and I think it's the way that I think a lot of Black students and Black people in general have coped, is to kind of drill down into that fire and that steel that's really at the core, I think, of part of the Black identity. But that is also hard, right? I mean, I remember saying during an interview once, it's exhausting, right, being Black and being the child of a single parent, because you think you have to juggernaut your way through things, right? And that's frankly been exhausting. I remember, and I've told my mentees this, and I also told members of the administration this, I think the way, so going back to coping, right, sort of you talked about how you cope with it and how you kind of move through the space and move through law school. I think one of the things that I did was I sort of had an awakening come 1L, and I realized what type of space Hastings really was. I realized, you know, the ideal that it projected, the picture it presented, and then the type of space it actually was, and in my judgment. And I realized that I needed to opt out of the game. That's how I coped. I need to opt out of the game. So instead of seeking the white gaze, progressive or otherwise, instead of seeking white proximity, which I think Hastings disguises in a number of forms, either through supposed merit, positions, you know, incentivizing certain positions and that sort of thing, proximity to whiteness for some sort of supposed safety or supposed positions in the future, right? These are all tactics I think Hastings uses, which are frankly part of the white supremacist playbook. But I think I decided to opt out. I think that came in second semester of 1L. I said, nope, that's it. And I actually drew a pie chart and I hung it up, and there's a little tiny piece that's shaded in. And what I realized was that little tiny shaded portion is everything that law school incentivizes, everything it says is of value, everything Hastings, I should say, not just a law school, incentivizes and says is of value. And the entire pie is everything that I had to offer. And the moment I realized that I needed to pour less energy into that little section and more energy into the entire pie and just be who I was and live authentically as a Black person in this space and demand that others recognize that and respect that, the more effective I would be and the happier I would be. And I think that's how I coped.
You know, I'm not going to change the world and I'm not going to change the school. Like, I accepted that. Mm-hmm. I recognize that those types of committees and groups like are coming from a good place and like a willingness to change, but also seeing it and like seeing at least, like, I think the students on it are great, but then seeing like the other side, the ones who actually are the ones that hold the power and like that bark, like really are the ones who end up making decisions and seeing things through. But like, you can't undo like the whiteness that they experience and they operate within. And like, that's not the work I can do. And I accept that. So I recognize that group's not going to necessarily give me anything. Right. And I guess I've never been like, I love it, but I do think like having that group's important, because even if it, like, aside like for moments like right now, where we're having like this moment of rupture and like everyone is like somehow magically aware for however long this fleeting moment lasts, having a group like that, even being present, means at least I'm getting one person, maybe. And like, maybe they don't know how to deal with it, and maybe they don't know like what to do, but like, I see that those spaces as important because they at least are generating ideas and having the conversation. And it's not great that it doesn't go anywhere, but I do think if I can get one person, right, to then like carry that into that one meeting to shut down that one bad idea, it's impactful.
I think it's a double-edged sword, because I think it does present the opportunity to have the consequences that you outlined, that you talked about. But I also think that it presents the opportunity for the school and the white administration to either consciously or unconsciously kind of look for their magical Negroes. And I think that's really dangerous, right? Because one, you know, no Black person should be subjected to that just on an individual level, right? But it's just also just a dangerous thing to do, right? I mean, and it's a dangerous sort of practice to engage in that white America has consistently engaged in for quite some time, right? Like, you know, I know we'll get this magical Negro, and this magical Negro will decode all the things that Black people need for us, need from us, or translate, because I just don't understand. Can you please translate this? Put it in a language that I can understand. And then, you know, either implicitly or explicitly, I also need you to just go ahead and solve those problems for me, because you're the magical Negro, right? And it's not always a Negro, a Black person, but, you know, in the context that we're talking about, it's decidedly going to be a Black person.
I hear the critique. I support the critique. But then I just, like, don't think there's a, like, I don't know what the right or, like, better formulation of it is, because I still think no matter who's in that position, we'll always be marginalized. And then if you don't have someone in that position, you just, the communities will say, like, you aren't representing us. There's nothing there. So,
well, I mean, I think the solution is not a solution, not the solution.
Yeah.
Is a possible solution is one, having faculty and administrators of color. So since we're talking about our community, Black faculty, mm-hmm. Black yeah. administrators, right? When you have the top of the pyramid is all white, then we're encountering the problem that you're talking about, right? So, okay, well, they're siloed. They kind of all think their own way. We're relying on their experiences, their level of knowledge about history, about their level of cultural competency, right? Whereas if those individuals, right, if there are five of them, hell, if two to three of them are Black, right, then that's much less of a lift. It's not as much of a heavy lift, right? Then we have cultural competency and understanding coming from both directions. Now, that person will still have to act as an administrator, will still have to do what they can for the college as a whole. We get all of that, but they bring that level of experience and competency to the table, right? And if something misses the group and it comes up the channel, then they go, oh, wait, hang on, are you kidding? Why? How'd this even get here? How'd this get this high up? What are you talking about, right? But, you know, if we can do that paired with committees or working groups like the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Working Group, that will lead to real change. And then also looking at the committee itself, I think what we do is, one, selecting who is on the committee should not be the academic dean and the dean and chancellor who are non-POC, who are not Black. Because, again, they're bringing their perspective and their lack of cultural competency to their selection process, whether they know it or not. Right? If BALSA membership and a PULSA membership, right? If you're in the upper level of the membership, president, vice president, chair, co-chair, you probably have enough on your plate, right? So can we make that a board position? Or can we elect an individual who the board selects as the elected representation for the community to be a part of that committee? And that person is accountable to the board and to the rest of the community. And it is community selected, uplifted by the community, not selected by the white power structure. The focus of the moment is internal organization, internal mobilization. That has to be, for me, the focus of the moment, because I personally believe that no one's going to help us like we will help us. And we will need allies along the way, but we must make Black health and safety and freedom the focus and the center of what we are doing in our movement. And we cannot be distracted by terms like diversity and inclusion, because we've seen what those have been used for and what they really mean.
I see what I understand it is. And like, this is probably like one of my biggest complaints generally about the school, but really comes into play here, is hire non-lawyers for jobs that don't need a JD. But if in the job description, it requires you to have a JD, you're losing out people who are culturally competent and actually have professional degrees in literally implicit bias, or like people who are race scholars who have a PhD in like student affairs. Like, you straight up say, no, we can't have you because you don't have this specific degree. And I would encourage the school straight up to look at those job descriptions and look at who you're hiring. But more importantly, get rid of that one line, because almost every position in our school requires that if you went to that school. Like, it just doesn't. So that'd be my first suggestion, is because you're going to end up getting more people who actually are culturally competent and like radically can like reshape everything and actually serve the needs of the offices.
Thank you for listening to Black Hastings Speaks. To hear all of the episodes in this series and learn more about the participants, go to www.uchastings.edu/speak.